Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather round the radio. It's time now for another installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harris, and it's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show with lots of good people involved. Its host and founder is Carol Marx. Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she's a champion in the battle against ageism. On this program, Carol will be talking with Howard J. Smith, an award-winning writer and author of Beethoven in Love, Opus 139, Concerto Quasi Una Fantasia, published by Say Yes Quickly Books. I'll tell you more about that in a moment. She'll also be talking with television host and expert psychologist Dr. Phil McGraw about managing type 2 diabetes. And she'll be speaking with Dr. Charlotte Yeh, the chief medical officer for AARP, about heart attacks. We'll also be joined by Stephen J.J. Wiseman, Esquire, and he'll be talking about tax scams. All that and more coming up on this installment of A Touch of Grey. Let's kick it off now with Carol Marx in conversation with Howard J. Smith. He's written the book Beethoven in Love, Opus 139, Concerto Quasi Una Fantasia, a daring, compelling, and impeccably researched historical novel that offers dramatic new insight into the life of one of the greatest composers the world has ever known. It's published by Say Yes Quickly Books.
Well, let me begin with the Napoleon aspect of this. Napoleon and Beethoven were exact contemporaries. They were born less than a year apart. They both rose to great heights simply on the dint of their own abilities, their own skill, their own enthusiasm for life and for what they were doing. And they lived somewhat parallel lives. They both knew well of each other. Beethoven had huge admiration for Napoleon in the early years. He was a believer in the concept, as many people were, of the French Revolution, which was about liberty, equality, and fraternity. And in the early years, Napoleon represented that to the people of Europe, and Napoleon was throwing off the chains of the aristocracy and the church throughout most of southern and central Europe. And Beethoven hugely admired that. And in fact, he wrote his third symphony, the one that we know as the Eroica or Heroic Symphony today. It was originally named Bonaparte. It was in honor of Napoleon. But when he first wrote it, Beethoven was considering moving from Vienna, where he had been living for about 10, 12 years, and possibly moving to Paris, which in those days had what we might call a much larger, more sophisticated music scene. He thought the opportunities there would be perhaps even greater than they were in Vienna. Vienna hadn't quite established its reputation as a center of music that it had later on after Beethoven's life. And so he wrote this. However, just as he was finishing up the manuscript, in 1802, 1803, word came to him, as it did to most of Europe, that Napoleon was crowning himself emperor. And Beethoven thought that this was such a betrayal of the concepts and the ideas of the revolution from 20 years earlier that he literally took his pen and scratched out, tearing the paper in the process, scratched out the name Bonaparte and changed the name to the Eroica Symphony. And in so doing, that manuscript still exists today in a museum in Germany. You can still see where he ripped it out. He was completely frustrated and angry. On the flip side, Napoleon knew well of Beethoven, admired his music, and it's thought that even when Napoleon installed his brother, Jerome, on the throne of a made-up kingdom in Westphalia that Napoleon had created, that he even tried to hire Beethoven through his brother Jerome, to be the concertmaster, the music master for the Kingdom of Westphalia. So they certainly knew of each other and admired each other. Even throughout his life, Beethoven had very mixed feelings about Napoleon.
That story, you really can't, you couldn't make it up, but it's true.
No, absolutely not. I mean, and the novel itself, every aspect of it, though, is highly fictionalized, and it takes place in this fictional realm. Every aspect of Beethoven looking back at his life is all based on the actual historical record.
And I know you did a lot of research for the book, and you used a lot of interesting original source materials. And I want to ask you, what was the one fact you learned about his life that really surprised you? Because my surprise was in learning that this musical genius wrote so many compositions. I mean, 600, in fact. And that so many of them were scores for songs. And I never knew about that.
Well, in a musical sense, yeah, that was, I think, what surprised me. I had no idea. I mean, like most people, I knew his big famous works, the Fifth Symphony, his piano concertos, some of the string quartets, obviously some of the sonatas like the Moonlight and the Pas de Tite. But I had no idea the full extent. Basically, Beethoven was a working stiff most of his life, even though he did get support, and what we call an annuity, from some of his friends in the aristocracy just to write. He never actually had a job working for anyone specifically as an employee. But he wrote all this material. That itself was rather incredible. And part of the wonderful part of this journey of researching his life and writing this book was discovering a lot of that music that I had not heard before. It was a great voyage of exploration. I happened to have been, back in college, an Asian Studies Chinese Philosophy major, and I was pretty familiar with a lot of the texts and the materials that had been written in China and India and so forth that had just begun to be translated into the European languages in the middle of the 17th, 18th centuries. And to suddenly read Beethoven's diaries that he's writing when he's in his 40s, and to come across literal quotes from things like the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu holy book, were fascinating. That here he was, his whole life, a seeker. He was looking for guidance and wisdom. Even though he was born Roman Catholic, he never practiced. He spent his whole life being self-educated and studying great minds from all over the world. He read the Greeks, he read the Romans, he read Egyptian texts. In translation, he read the Hindu. And conversely, Napoleon was reading a lot of the Chinese material as well, Confucius and so forth. And if you actually look, and this is the great irony, if you look at the actual text of the Ode to Joy, it in fact has more to do with an Asian philosophic approach and look at the world than anything coming out of Western culture and history. And ironically, it is now the theme of a somewhat united Europe.
Somewhat, right. But, you know, that's just another amazing coincidence. And I want to talk a little bit more about Beethoven's role in really the development of Western classical music, because, again, through your book, I really realized how radical his music was for its time. And I really never had looked at that before. So what was the music like before Beethoven started composing his symphonies? And how did he change the whole milieu of it?
Well, Beethoven, for his time, was as radical, let's say, as Jimi Hendrix playing Purple Haze. At a time when people like Haydn were composing the equivalent of the quartet singing Mr. Sandman in four-part harmony, it was so shatteringly different that it took a long time, actually, for it to be digested by the music world. But he literally transformed the nature of music. It went from under Haydn and early Mozart to where music was about the form and the structure, and you wrote music for the court. Beethoven got rid of the rules and also used the rules to his own advantage. He completely transformed that, and his music was full of passion and personal meaning and intent that simply did not exist before. Mozart, who had preceded him and died just before Beethoven reached Vienna for the second time and moved there and never left Vienna as a resident for the rest of his life, Mozart had just begun to sort of get into that near the end of his career, and he died very young, in his mid-30s. Beethoven kind of inherited that tradition. He loved Mozart's writing and was inspired to take it many steps further and transform it And he becomes a transitional figure from what is known technically in modern times as the classical era to the romantic era. And he is the force in the middle of both of those who took one form and turned it into something else. And by the time he finished the Ninth Symphony, when he was 54 in the 1820s, he completely and profoundly altered the nature of the symphony, of the string quartet, of piano trios, the pianos concerto, piano sonata, unrecognizable in some sense from the strict format they had had before he entered the scene.
Well, you call him, and that is really something that's a sentence in your book that will remain in my mind forever, because you called him the first rock star. And was that partly due to the amazing number of women he loved and had affairs with? I mean, I was just, really surprised about that, although you write that a lot of erotic things were going on with the aristocracy or the people that he was associated with. And so was that partly true for his, for you calling him that, and also the fact that he really was the first composer that had people actually going out of their homes, often to a public place where they would hear him perform?
Well, that's true. Before Beethoven's time, music was performed, usually classical serious music, was performed in one of two venues, either performed at the court for royalty or in what were small gatherings of chamber music that were done in people's homes. And it was not something that was done. You didn't go to concerts traditionally. That had begun to change just before Beethoven hit the scene, where a rising middle class with money and the ability to compose and play music had begun to start going to public venues, places were adapted, like gardens and so forth, theaters, opera houses, for just strictly classical music. That was something of a new phenomenon. And in a sense, he was a rock star. He didn't have the money that a modern rock star had, but he certainly had kind of the aura when he first hit Vienna as a very young man. And he was, many women were attracted to him, and there was a phrase, even one of his friends, one of his lifelong friends, said, Beethoven was an Adonis. Women were always attracted to him. I think in the same way people were attracted to a young Mick Jagger. He was a star, and he was a great performer who, in piano competition, they pit pianists against each other like bulls in a ring, and he would outperform everyone, and yet he was something of an iconoclast. He was independent. He brooked nothing from fools. He was a genius in his own right, and he was very attractive, and we don't know for sure the full extent of his affairs, but there are 6 volumes of letters, 3 volumes of letters to Beethoven, and they're big, fat, thick volumes, and 3 volumes of letters that he wrote. And there's a lot of very passionate writing going on in those letters, the most famous of which was not discovered until after his death, and that's the Immortal Beloved Letter, which most people have sort of heard about tangentially. But it was a 3 or 4 page letter written when he was in his early 40s to a woman that we don't even know who it is, because he didn't put her name on the letter and he didn't put a year. He just put the date, and he wrote it over a period of several days. We don't even know if he sent it, but he certainly saved it. And it was found among his papers along with another document called the Heiligenstadt Testament, which he wrote when he was about 32. And it's essentially a kind of a rant and a will and a suicide note all at the same time.
That was Carol Marks in conversation with Howard J. Smith. His book, Beethoven in Love, Opus 139, Concerto Quasi Una Fantasia, is published by Say Yes Quickly Books. More of this conversation, you've heard an excerpt. More is available on the Touch of Grey website, www.atouchofgrey.com. I'm Michael Harrison in the Anchor Chair. Coming up next, Carol Marks in conversation with Dr. Phil about managing type 2 diabetes. That's next when A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in just a moment.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. 1 in 3 American senior citizens injures themselves in a fall every year. That means that nearly all of the country's senior population is at risk of a life-changing injury that may result in a loss of independence and a long period of rehabilitation or even death. The most common injuries related to falls are head trauma and hip fractures, according to the Centers for Disease Control. So how can you prevent such an event? Have a home safety evaluation from a licensed physical therapist, routine visits to your medical doctor, exercise 3 times a week for strength and balance training, semi-annual eye exams, and a monthly review of your medications by a doctor or pharmacist. Every time you walk out the door or even get out of bed in the morning, you run the risk of injuring yourself by a fall. Taking these preventative measures, you do minimize these chances. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
So when we brought him home, we didn't realize that Bear, the rescue dog, was actually sick. He had very flaky skin. He was dropping a lot of fur, and the vet wanted to do steroid injections, special dog food. Nothing seemed to work. So I've been hearing Dynovite on the radio for years.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
It never actually crossed my mind to try it until I was just at a dead end. And then it finally sunk in. Oh, you're talking about hair and skin. And all right, I'll try it. Well, it took probably 6 weeks, but after we started using Dynovite, no more flaky skin. He doesn't scratch and itch, and he started to put weight on. It was awesome. He makes us feel like we saved him. Every rescue dog in America deserves Dynovite for 90 days. I wish that we would have started the Dynovite right away. It would have been so much easier.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
My joints used to kill me. I'd wake up with stiff knees and a stiff back, and it wouldn't get much better throughout the day. I went to doctors and took almost every supplement you can think of, and nothing seemed to help. Then I found something called Oil Can Joint Lubricant. They use only top-of-the-line, all-natural ingredients, and I know many companies make similar claims, but here's the big difference. Oil Can ingredients are scientifically formulated to work together faster than anything else in the marketplace. That's guaranteed. I take Oil Can every day. My knee pain was gone in just a few days. So if you have knee pain, back pain, and you've tried everything, try Oil Can Joint Lubricant risk-free right now. I'm confident you'll have fewer aches and pains within days, or we will gladly refund your money. Call right now. 800-430-9466. 800-430-9466. 800-430-9466. 800-430-9466.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host of the program, Carol Marks, in a brief conversation with Dr. Phil McGraw, about managing type 2 diabetes. Dr. Phil is the host of America's number one daytime talk show, and he is perhaps the most well-known media expert in the field of psychology and human functioning.
One of the things that you talk about is it's so important to have a good support system both within and outside of your family. So how do you go about creating one? I know that your lovely wife, Robin, must have helped you keep healthy through all these years.
Oh, my gosh. She is so good about that. And I tell you, it begins with your healthcare professional, because this is not something you can do on your own. You've got to have some medical help here. And it begins with that healthcare professional. For me, it involved a nutritionist. And, you know, for people that say, well, gosh, Dr. Phil, I can't afford to go hire a nutritionist, there are such great resources on the Internet where you can understand the composition of the food that you're eating and the impact it has on your body. It involves your spouse. You talk to your spouse. Let them know that the choices that you make have a profound impact on your health. If you've got someone that you walk with, that you work out with, if you can build a team around you that they're all pulling for the same results, it can really help you gain momentum and create a lifestyle that's programmed to support your goal. So, you know, I say, first off, step one, I call it move forward. Change your attitude. Don't have shame and guilt about this. Embrace it. And step two is get educated, not just you, but your spouse, your family members, so everybody knows the impact of what they're doing. And third is build that team to support you in changing bad habits. And then make a plan that's not willpower driven. I mean, change your lifestyle. Because this is something you've got to stick with. This disease is not going to go away. But if you manage it, I tell you, at this point, I can tell you, Carol, I don't even have to think about it every day because it's so folded into my lifestyle that it's just my new normal.
And that's absolutely wonderful to hear because a lot of people haven't gotten to that state. And so you are, you know, inspiring people with what you've been able to do. Do you have any advice on how to stay committed to your plan, which, you know, of course, was a healthy diet, exercise, and your medication? And do you have any advice about being able to stick to it?
Well, I do. And it is, don't try to do this, excuse me, don't try to do this by willpower. I think willpower is a myth. It's fickle. It will be great when you're all excited and you're fired up and it's new and you're going to do it. That's all good. But that doesn't last forever. What you have to do is set up your world to support what you want to do. If it's hard for you to exercise once you get home, take your exercise clothes with you to work, for example, and do it on the way home. If you get home and it's too comfy on the couch, then do it before you get there. Program things. If you just have a tendency to go by those vending machines at work and get snacks, don't carry change. I mean, sometimes it's just common sense of programming your environment to support what you're doing. It's not a matter of willpower. It's just programming yourself for success.
That's Dr. Phil McGraw in conversation with Carol Marks about managing type 2 diabetes. Up next, Carol Marks in conversation with Dr. Charlotte Yeh, the Chief Medical Officer of AARP. She's written an article about the latest updates regarding heart attacks. That's next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here on this great talk radio station in a moment.
Michael Harrison here with you on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. Very proud to be with you on this program. This program has been on the air in one form or another consistently now for over two decades. Kind of runs below the radar. It's heard on weekends on great talk radio stations around the country. And what I'm really proud about in terms of this program in which I have the opportunity to serve as anchor, not as host. Carol Marks is the host, and I certainly am not the only voice on this show. We have a roundtable of outstanding personalities, experts, and broadcasters. What I love about this show is that in an industry marked by concern, focus, obsession with youth, and believe me, I'm about as young thinking as anybody you'll meet. Sometimes I'm even accused of being immature. And so I'm all for that, and I'm all for looking ahead. But I'm also for fairness, and I'm also for respect. And the media in America, driven by, obviously, Madison Avenue and commercial concerns, focuses primarily on young people. And if somebody's over 50 or 55 or 60, they quite often find that there's a lot lacking in terms of what's available in the mainstream media. So this program, which was conceived and developed by Carol Marks more than 20 years ago, originally was called Senior Focus, and it evolved into A Touch of Gray, and I became involved with it along the way, is something that really provides a service in as much as it unashamedly, unabashedly, unapologetically brings information to people via this wonderful medium of radio that is of use, of interest, of service, of comfort, of support to people over 50 years of age and their families, which is why I say at the beginning of the program, children of all ages, because so many people in their 50s find themselves in a situation that has been kind of accurately and colorfully termed the sandwich generation, meaning they have children, adult children, still living with them, and
abiding by the rule that came down a long time ago, honor thy father and thy mother, they have their parents living with them. In many cases, these parents are in their 80s, 90s, and are living at home. And the amount of pressure that can be put on somebody dealing with adult children and senior parents all under one roof is extraordinary, and it's a phenomenon that in many ways I applaud. I'm all for family staying together. But also there are people who are in need of support and information. So in many ways, A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, is in fact a program for children of all ages. But I salute Carol Marx. I think that she has done and continues to do a remarkable job. And she does it under sometimes the worst of conditions because, like the rest of us, she's not getting any younger either. But she drives herself to research and get the information needed and select guests and topics. And not only that, she travels around the world and brings information from other countries on how their healthcare systems operate and how the services that they provide for senior citizens there are taken care of and done. And she brings that information back, not to mention she acts as a model, as a role model for people to get up and get out and live life and do things. And she's done everything from, she's explored, you know, if there were four corners on this planet, as the saying goes, she's been to all four of them. Check her out at the website, atouchofgray.com. Gray is spelled with an E. And I just wanted to mention that she is one fine lady, and we're grateful to be involved with her in this project.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com.
So when we brought him home, we didn't realize that Bear, the rescue dog, was actually sick. He had very flaky skin. He was dropping a lot of fur, and the vet wanted to do steroid injections, special dog food. Nothing seemed to work. So I've been hearing DinoVite on the radio for years.
DinoVite.com.
859-428-1000.
It never actually crossed my mind to try it until I was just at a dead end. And then it finally sunk in. Oh, you're talking about hair and skin. And all right, I'll try it. Well, it took probably 6 weeks, but after we started using DinoVite, no more flaky skin. He doesn't scratch and itch, and he started to put weight on. It was awesome. He makes us feel like we saved him. Every rescue dog in America deserves DinoVite for 90 days. I wish that we would have started the DinoVite right away. It would have been so much easier.
859-428-1000.
DinoVite.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host of our program, Carol Marx, in conversation with Dr. Charlotte Yeh, the chief medical officer of AARP, who's written an article about the latest updates regarding heart attacks.
A heart attack is actually, you know, like all of your organs in your body, you have blood vessels that feed the organ, like your heart. So there are arteries that go to your heart that bring in blood and oxygen and nutrients. And sometimes what happens is those arteries start getting clogged, or they get a clot, or they get blocked off. And when that happens, your heart muscle is starved of blood and starved of nutrient and oxygen, and it causes a heart attack, or those heart muscles start, heart cells start to die.
Now, my next question that I have for you is the fact, you know, we read and we hear a lot about sudden heart attacks. So what are they? Are they dangerous? And who is most likely to have a sudden heart attack?
Well, of course, anyone is at risk for a heart attack, and there are many causes that can happen. But the most common, as I said, is when those arteries are clogged. So risk factors include if, you know, you have a family history of heart attacks and early heart attacks, you might be at more risk. There's a higher risk if you're a smoker. There's a higher risk if, you know, you're overweight and, you know, high cholesterol, you know, high fats, triglycerides. Those are all the kinds of factors where you may be at more of a risk for a heart attack. And if you are under a lot of stress, high blood pressure, those can also lead to a higher risk of heart attack.
Now, what we call a silent heart attack, someone really wouldn't have any symptoms, is that correct, if you had one? So how would you know?
So it is possible to have a silent heart attack where it may be a small enough vessel, you know, one of the little teeny tiny branches or a smaller vessel, where it got clogged and the amount of heart muscle tissues that were affected is much smaller. So you may not have felt that. Or in many cases, people don't always recognize the signs of a heart problem or a heart attack. So they could, you know, have indigestion or feel short of breath and ignore those symptoms. And in retrospect, it turned out it was a heart attack. So silent may not only be there's no symptoms, but it may be you had symptoms that you didn't recognize. The best way the way it's typically found out is, when you go and see your physician on a regular basis, they oftentimes will do what's called an EKG, a cardiogram of your heart, and sometimes it will show up that way. Or you might start having that indigestion that you thought was nothing, and as they continues to come back, especially when you're walking or exercise or that shortness of breath, then during the evaluation, they may discover you might have had an earlier heart attack that you weren't aware of.
Now, the article that you were involved in getting into AARP's magazine talks about the fact that as we get older, you know, we don't experience the typical signs, but instead we're more apt to experience confusion, labored breathing, and to feel faint. So why do we have these couple of these symptoms that are so different?
Well, and actually that is even more common in women. Women are less likely to have those classic symptoms of pressure in the chest, fist, you know, elephant sitting on your chest, pain that goes to the shoulder and the jaw. With women, it oftentimes could be a feeling of indigestion, could be a feeling of shortness of breath. You might feel lightheaded and faint because your heart rhythm may be off, so you're not getting the blood flow to the brain. And the reason that happens is, you know, we're all different. It all depends what part of the heart muscle is affected, and if it's affecting the blood flow to other organs, and that's why you may feel different symptoms.
Well, one of the most interesting and helpful things in the article concerned some research that was done at a university in Sweden, and it talked about the fact that if you're not feeling well, some people had those feelings that they just didn't feel well, and that was really prior to their having a heart attack. So that is kind of a very good thing to be aware of.
Right. You can oftentimes feel this sort of sudden fatigue. And again, your heart is a very important organ and muscle because it pumps blood to the rest of your heart, rest of your body. Well, if that gets damaged, your heart is not pumping as well, or it might be an irregular rhythm, so it's not pumping strongly and regularly enough. And so when you don't get enough blood flow to the rest of your body, it could give you that feeling of fatigue, a little bit of confusion because the blood's not going up to your brain. And if you have clogged arteries that are in your heart, they may be elsewhere in your body, so you may be more susceptible. You know, if your heart's not pumping as well, the blood flow may not be flowing as well to your brain because you may have some damage and clogging in some of those arteries as well. So that's why as you get older, you might find, beyond the classic symptoms, a period of confusion, fatigue. So anytime you have something that comes on unexpectedly and you know, and is outside your norm, it is something that is worth calling your doctor.
You're listening to a conversation between the host of our program, Carol Marks, and Dr. Charlotte Yeh, the chief medical officer of AARP, who's written an article about the latest updates regarding heart attacks. The conversation between Carol Marks and Dr. Yeh will continue on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, in just a moment.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. 1 in 3 American senior citizens injures themselves in a fall every year. That means that nearly all of the country's senior population is at risk of a life-changing injury that may result in a loss of independence and a long period of rehabilitation or even death. The most common injuries related to falls are head trauma and hip fractures, according to the Centers for Disease Control. So how can you prevent such an event? Have a home safety evaluation from a licensed physical therapist, routine visits to your medical doctor, exercise 3 times a week for strength and balance training, semi-annual eye exams, and a monthly review of your medications by a doctor or pharmacist. Every time you walk out the door or even get out of bed in the morning, you run the risk of injuring yourself by a fall. Taking these preventative measures, you do minimize these chances. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at premiergeriatricrn.com.
So when we brought him home, we didn't realize that Bear, the rescue dog, was actually sick. He had very flaky skin. He was dropping a lot of fur, and LeVette wanted to do steroid injections, special dog food. Nothing seemed to work. So I've been hearing Dinovite on the radio for years.
Dinovite.com.
859-428-1000.
It never actually crossed my mind to try it until I was just at a dead end. And then it finally sunk in. Oh, you're talking about hair and skin. And all right, I'll try it. Well, it took probably 6 weeks, but after we started using Dinovite, no more flaky skin. He doesn't scratch and itch. And he started to put weight on. It was awesome. He makes us feel like we saved him. Every rescue dog in America deserves Dinovite for 90 days. I wish that we would have started the Dinovite right away. It would have been so much easier.
859-428-1000.
Dinovite.com.
Do you have pain from arthritis in your knees? It's no wonder. Osteoarthritis affects 1 in 2 adults. That's 50% of us in our lifetime will suffer from arthritis knee pain. If you're covered by Medicare or within 90 days of turning 65, we can help relieve your knee pain. Call right now and see how you can get a pain-relieving knee brace at little or no cost to you. 800-368-6704. 800-368-6704. At the Health Alert Hotline, we have consultants ready to help you learn how an easy-to-wear knee brace can help stop the pain so you can be active again. And after we work with Medicare to get you approved, you can get our high-quality pain-relieving knee brace at little or no cost to you. Call the Health Alert Hotline right now for free shipping and to learn more. 800-368-6704. 800-368-6704. That's 800-368-6704.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host of our program, Carol Marks, in conversation with Dr. Charlotte Yeh, the chief medical officer of AARP, who's written an article about the latest updates regarding heart attacks.
The article goes on to point out that it's so important that if you are having some symptoms of a possible heart attack, that you need to get off the internet and call 911. You need to get to the hospital within an hour. So why is it so important that you call 911 immediately? And equally important, getting to that hospital in less than an hour.
Okay, so remember, you know, as we talked about what a heart attack is, it's when those blood vessels get clogged and you get no blood flowing to that very vital heart muscle. And the longer you don't get blood flow, the more damage and maybe the larger the size of damage. So that's why we want you to get care as quickly as possible, because there are drugs that can be used to dissolve the clot. In some cases, you can have an emergency, what we call angiogram, which is a heart dye to look at the vessels and have what's called a stent to open it up, or even emergency surgery. But the faster we can open up those vessels, the less damage there will be to the heart, and your heart muscle cells could still recover. The reason we say call 911, it's not only the speed issue, but if you're having a heart attack, you can get a sudden irregular rhythm in your heart and you could collapse. And the last thing we want to have happen is on your way to the hospital, and if you're driving and you collapse, now you have an accident and trauma on top of a heart attack. The third reason is when you can call 911, we now have, you know, paramedics, as you know, they have drugs, they have equipment, they have cardiogram. They can actually do your cardiogram, transmit it to the hospital they're going. The team can already be assembling and getting ready in place, even as you're on the way to the hospital. So it can also save time that way as well.
Absolutely.
Now, interestingly enough, is women are actually less likely to call an ambulance than men. And in fact, over half the time when women are having heart attacks, they do not call an ambulance. And when you explore that, you know, it's really very interesting. They don't want to bother the neighbors. They don't want a lot of noise in front of their house. My house isn't clean. I can't have anybody come into the house. I'm not dressed. And so if there's anything that's truly important is for women, you're more, it's more difficult because your symptoms are not as classic. And number two, we're so busy caring for other people, we don't think of ourselves. And number three, you know, we, feel like we're in charge of our house and our home, and we don't want to bother others. And those are thoughts and ideas you should just set aside because, you know, it is one of the leading causes of death for women.
And you go on to say that once we have called 911 and then we're waiting for the ambulance, that it's very important to take aspirin. What kind of aspirin should we take, and why is that important?
Yeah, so while you're waiting, if you're not already taking a daily aspirin, you definitely should take one. It could be as small as a baby aspirin, or you can take an adult aspirin. And the reason that's important is aspirin has both an anti-inflammatory capability, and it also keeps your platelets, which help your blood to clot, from getting less sticky. So it could reduce the chance of a clot forming, you know, as the artery may be clotting or having spasms. So we have found that that can also make a difference in outcome. So absolutely, it's an easy thing. You know, usually everybody has aspirin in their house.
Absolutely. Now, in the article, it also talks about better tests for detecting a heart attack in progress or for screening for future risks, and that some of these new tests are in the pipeline. Can you tell us about some of them?
Well, I do know there are a number of tests in the pipeline. I, you know, probably don't know all of them, but we are getting more and more sophisticated with laboratory testing. There's an enzyme, for example, when a cell gets damaged, a muscle cell gets damaged, that's called troponin. It's a particular enzyme. And when a cell gets damaged, it releases this enzyme called troponin, gets into your bloodstream. We are now getting more and more sophisticated that we can distinguish, you know, did that come from damaged muscle or come from damaged heart, and identify what kind of muscle cell that occurred. We can now detect smaller and smaller amounts so we can pick it up earlier in the process. And then what we really watch for is not just is there sudden release of the troponin, but also, did it stay up or did it taper off? And, you know, we watch it over time to make sure there's not ongoing damage.
That's Dr. Charlotte Yeh in conversation with the host of our program, Carol Marks. Charlotte Yeh is the chief medical officer of AARP, and she's just written an article about the latest updates regarding heart attacks. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. Coming up next, Steve Wiseman, our senior correspondent, will be talking about tax fraud information that you should know about. That's next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here on this great talk radio station in just a moment.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. 1 in 3 American senior citizens injures themselves in a fall every year. That means that nearly all of the country's senior population is at risk of a life-changing injury that may result in a loss of independence and a long period of rehabilitation or even death. The most common injuries related to falls are head trauma and hip fractures, according to the Centers for Disease Control. So how can you prevent such an eventuality? Have a home safety evaluation from a licensed physical therapist? Routine visits to your medical doctor? Exercise 3 times a week for strength and balance training? Semi-annual eye exams? And a monthly review of your medications by a doctor or pharmacist? Every time you walk out the door, or even get out of bed in the morning, you run the risk of injuring yourself by a fall. Taking these preventative measures, you do minimize these chances. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
So when we brought him home, we didn't realize that Bear, the rescue dog, was actually sick. He had very flaky skin. He was dropping a lot of fur, and LeVette wanted to do steroid injections, special dog food. Nothing seemed to work. So I've been hearing Dinovite on the radio for years.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
It never actually crossed my mind to try it until I was just at a dead end. And then it finally sunk in. Oh, you're talking about hair and skin. And all right, I'll try it. Well, it took probably 6 weeks, but after we started using Dinovite, no more flaky skin. He doesn't scratch and itch. And he started to put weight on. It was awesome. He makes us feel like we saved him. Every rescue dog in America deserves Dinovite for 90 days. I wish that we would have started the Dinovite right away. It would have been so much easier.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
My joints used to kill me. I'd wake up with stiff knees and a stiff back, and it wouldn't get much better throughout the day. I went to doctors and took almost every supplement you can think of, and nothing seemed to help. Then I found something called Oil Can Joint Lubricant. They use only top-of-the-line, all-natural ingredients, and I know many companies make similar claims, but here's the big difference. Oil Can ingredients are scientifically formulated to work together faster than anything else in the marketplace. That's guaranteed. I take Oil Can every day. My knee pain was gone in just a few days. So if you have knee pain, back pain, and you've tried everything, try Oil Can Joint Lubricant risk-free right now. I'm confident you'll have fewer aches and pains within days, or we will gladly refund your money. Call right now. 800-430-9466. 800-430-9466. 800-430-9466. 800-430-9466.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We come to the final segment of the program and another visit from Steve Wiseman, our senior correspondent. He's an attorney, and when he's an attorney, we call him Stephen J.J. Wiseman, Esquire. He's also a prolific author, and he is an enemy of fraud. He is an enemy of scammers. And let me tell you, he's the real deal. He's a good guy. I've known him for over 20 years, and I would certainly feel safe in a foxhole with Steve Wiseman. So let me tell you now, he's here to discuss income tax identity theft, and he really knows a lot about it because he's written The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall. He has a website called scamicide.com. So let's see what he's got in store for us. Income tax identity theft. Steve, take it away.
Thank you, Michael. Want some good news or bad news? All right, I'll give you both. The good news, according to the IRS, is that their crack teams of forensic accountants prevented the payment of $1.5 billion in fraudulent tax refund checks last year. You want the bad news? Bad news is a report done by the Treasury Department predicts the IRS will pay more than $21 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars in fraudulent tax refund checks over the next 5 years. And if that's not bad enough, here's some worse news. If an identity thief manages to file a tax return using your name and Social Security number before you do, it could be well over a year before you get your legitimate tax refund. And tax identity theft is getting worse, not better. And you really can't depend on the IRS to protect you. Identity thieves who manage to steal your name and social security number are filing early returns before you can with a phony W-2 and getting huge refunds while your refund, the legitimate one, gets stuck in bureaucratic hell when you file your legitimate tax return. But let's just really look at this and make it worse, because the IRS is talking about all they're doing with new special programs to identify. Here's the key thing they're not doing, and I don't see this, you know, anywhere that it's been written. When a W-2 is sent in by an employer, not even sent to the IRS, W-2 forms aren't required to be filed by employers until February or March, depending on the manner that the employer uses for filing. In fact, as I said, it's not even filed with the IRS, but done with Social Security. Social Security doesn't even send those documents over to the IRS until the late summer, and the IRS doesn't match the W-2s filed with the W-2s filed by employers until August, well after the IRS has already paid income tax returns based, in many cases, on counterfeit W-2s. So how easy would it be to merely require employers to file W-2s with the IRS at the same time they file them with Social Security and have the IRS match the phony W-2s with the W-2s that are filed by employers and then be able to see if there's identity theft? But that's a bit too easy. The bottom line is, first of all, you've got to protect your Social Security number. Second of all, you've got to file early. The filing date was extended a little bit because of the government shutdown, but now is the time to file, so don't put it off.
Thank you, Steve Wiseman. Income tax identity theft. You don't know where to turn and where the next culprit will be, what tree the next fraud artist will jump out from behind. But Steve Wiseman's there to protect us. Check out scamaside.com, his website. Check out The Truth About Avoiding Scams, his book about the subject, published by Prentice Hall. And Steve Wiseman is a regular feature of A Touch of Gray. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, of course, to Kevin Casey. And great thanks and respect to Carol Marks, one of America's leading experts in upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism and the host of our program. On behalf of all of us at A Touch of Gray, I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another installment